Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm sitting here on stage in the beautiful Art Deco Empire Arts Center in downtown Grand Forks, North Dakota. On the stage next to me is my father, a legendary jazz musician, and in front of me are hundreds of Y Radio fans who have braved... You've braved the below zero temperatures to commemorate a wonderful milestone. This month, the show is 10 years old. Tonight, we'll be exploring the logic of jazz. But before we do, I have never been happier and prouder to say, wherever you are, wherever you are listening to this, welcome to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I grew up hearing two types of music, bebop jazz and Cuban salsa. Sometimes the jazz came from the stereo, but more often than not, it emitted from my father's flute. It was perennial, ever-present. I could not avoid it even if I wanted to. Salsa surrounded me too. It was the heartbeat of the Hispanic neighborhood we lived in. When I heard my father play that, it was always via trombone on recordings from a life he led before I was old enough to notice. My father's a musician. That makes me his permanent audience. This is why I said I grew up hearing the music rather than listening to it. I listened to punk and ska, the music I chose for myself when I was 11, but I heard jazz. For me, it was just as normal as sunshine and experienced just as thoughtlessly. Whatever tastes and jazz preferences I have, I developed without reflection or any deep knowledge. I had an intimate relationship with the music, but I didn't understand it. On today's episode, we're going to explore jazz, but preparing to do so forces me to ask two difficult philosophical questions. How do we discuss that which we take for granted? And how do we investigate the involuntary soundtracks of our own lives? It would be easy for me to describe the emotions that jazz inspires in me, although they run deep enough that I probably ought to do it with my therapist before I do it before a live audience. But considering the logic of jazz allows me to investigate the parts I have no intimate connection to, the craft, the music theory, the conversational back and forth each album plays a part in. The logic undergirds the rules and methods that allow musicians to play together, that allows them to be improvisational yet predictable. It tells performers what key to play in and how to hear each other. It gives them the structures to harmonize while having the freedom to assert their own voice. Knowing as little as I do about all of this puts me in a paradoxical position. I'm talking about something I know as well as my own breath, but I'm participating as a novice. I'm comfortably at home, but I'm ignorant. Here's the thing. I suspect that the vast majority of people experience jazz the way I do. Most listeners aren't musicians, and even fewer are philosophers. People know what they like, but they don't know why they like. And asking them to explain their musical taste tends to make them uneasy. They become defensive, as if they're being asked to justify their emotions. Anyone can like something that isn't very good, but can we like something and be wrong? I'm not so sure. In 1965, John Coltrane released A Love Supreme, one of the greatest jazz albums of all time. Aficionados classify it as a modal or free jazz. Train's tone is precise, although not perfect, like Miles Davis's can be. He weaves his saxophone through the other instruments, sometimes barely touching them, in much the same way Michelangelo's God barely touches his Adam. Reviewers have described the album as a complete statement. Listeners experience it as mystical. What a weird mishmash of technical and subjective terms my description of A Love Supreme is. Modal and free jazz denote something specific, mystical doesn't. We can objectively compare Coltrane's tone with Davis's, but what does it mean for instruments to touch one another? Claiming music is precise is one thing, saying it's complete is another. What does all of this mean? Sure, it's coherent, but is it logical? How do you make objective statements about something that is so subjective? How do you explain the causal relationship between musical notes when nothing in music is inevitable? These are the tensions that any musician takes for granted. To claim jazz is logical is not to say that it is only so. To say it is emotional is not to say that it's arbitrary. The jazz tradition is the ever-expanding realm of permission musicians have to find their own voices. It is born of European classical music and African rhythms, of American ingenuity and the crushing inhumanity of chattel slavery. As contradictory as this history is, the music still makes sense. It can be discussed. It can be explained, even if I personally am not competent enough to do it myself. So my father played jazz and I heard it. And while his music meant something very different to him than to me, this is true of all performances. The artist and the audience share only brief touches, again, like God and Adam. But that's the point, isn't it? It isn't the recording that matters. It's the people and their ephemeral connections. Louis Armstrong begat Miles Davis, who begat Wynton Marsalis. My father begat me. His music begat mine. And these two people who live together in a small apartment in New York City now meet on stage in Grand Forks, North Dakota. It's all jazz. It's all improvisation. And that, if you don't mind me saying so, is what makes it all so beautiful. And now our guest. Mark Weinstein is a professor of education at Montclair State University in New Jersey. He has a PhD in philosophy, specializing in mathematical logic. He is also an award-winning jazz musician. With 19 albums to his name, his fearless world music recordings fuse bebop with Cuban, Brazilian, African, Argentinian, and Jewish music tradition. Hi, Pops. Welcome to Why.
You know, I've been listening to these things that you do, and I always like the monologues better than anything anybody else says. So I'm going to leave. In fact, you know, the things you said are so incredibly profound, as they always are in your monologues, that I have no idea how to respond, except to say that jazz is a human phenomena. It's an interaction between people, history, the instruments that they play, the audiences that listen, the economic environment that stifles or supports them. And throughout that, jazz has tried to balance in a very strange way. Somebody said this about, they were talking about Andy Warhol. They said that fine art looks to innovation and popular art looks to acceptance. That's a cliche. But jazz musicians live in that cliche because jazz started as popular music, people playing music for people in venues where they were intended to entertain, to give background, to give enjoyment, to give cover, to give noise, to give excuse for the nefarious things that were going on when the jazz musicians were playing. And at the same time, Louis Armstrong, most essentially, saw that as a vehicle to extend the music that he had inherited from listening to brass bands, from having to play brass band music with fewer musicians than the brass band required, with musicians that were less tutored than the brass band tradition demanded. And he saw in the limitations of jazz the possibilities of personal expression. And that has persisted no matter how popular or successful the jazz musician has been. The struggle to get enough acceptance to survive and to find a way of innovating within a community of other musicians. Because although jazz needs listeners, jazz is first and foremost a life choice of the musicians who dedicate their life to its performance.
Okay, I wanna hold off for a second on the sort of the relationship between musicians. And I've been thinking a lot about a conversation that we had yesterday. You came to UND, you gave a master class to the jazz band, and you had a conversation with the director of the band. And he was talking about his jazz life, and it was incredibly interesting. And he said that he was inspired to jazz by listening to Doc Severinsen. And we are in the land of Lawrence Welk, who also has a big band. Now, I grew up, right, Spanish Harlem, Washington Heights. I'm your son. I hear about Louis Armstrong and Ornette Coleman and John Coltrane. Is the big band of Lawrence Welk and Doc Severinsen the same as the big band of Duke Ellington? Is it just a regional difference? Because I know that the romance of jazz is much more about the Southern African-American experience, urban African-American experience, yet there are plenty of jazz lovers in this audience now. So how do we balance that Lawrence Welk culture with the Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong culture?
I loved to listen to Lawrence Welk on television when I was a kid because I loved music. And Lawrence Welk had fine, fine, fine musicians. I used to watch that band and see them as a model of perfection because not one guy in that band ever played a note that didn't have a beautiful sound, that wasn't perfectly in tune, that was perfect in the rhythm for what the kind of music he played. Doc Severinsen is one of the greatest trumpet players of all times. Technically, guy is a master. The guy's a monster. He made records that trumpet players fall over the floor listening to. His technical proficiency is unparalleled. And the musicians in his band, including a trombone teacher that I once studied with, got to play 0.1% of what they were capable of playing. And they got very well paid for it. The guys in Duke Ellington's band were stretched every single night of their life. The guys in Duke Ellington's band, who could play their instruments as well as the guys in Lawrence Welk, had to play a level of musical risk. That's all I'm going to say. I'm trying to think of a better word, but that's the best word. They had to risk. Somebody once said that a jazz musician has to play every night as if his life depends on it. That's what jazz musicians do. The worst insult that you can say about someone who played a gig is that he phoned the gig in.
Okay, so what does it mean to engage in a musical risk? I mean, obviously, right, there's, you play badly, you lose the job, right? But there's an artistic notion of risk. What does that mean? What does it mean to risk something when you're playing music?
Okay, what does it mean to play as if your life depended on it? It means that if you died the next second, you would be happy that you died playing that. That's the essence of what jazz musicians try for, to play everything they play with a total degree of engagement and integrity, expressiveness, and because musicians are egotists, and because musicians are athletes of the small muscles. It's a wonderful phrase, athletes of the small muscles. A musician is as much an athlete as a quarterback, except his muscles are in his fingers or the tiny little muscles around his or her mouth. So you always want to, like every athlete, you always want to be at the peak of your abilities. You want to be performing in a way that shows the tremendous accomplishment that's the result of a life of effort. So you put those two things together. Tremendous emotional integrity, incredible physical demands, and, because so far we could be talking about rock and roll, a degree of intellectual sophistication that comes from always searching for new harmonic, melodic, rhythmic, world influences, etc., etc.
So I'm already doing things a lot quicker than I had planned, but we talked about Louis Armstrong, we talk about Risk. There's a very, very famous track by him, West End Blues, which is influential in a whole bunch of ways. So what I'd like to do is play a little bit of the song, and why don't you tell us about the risk that he's taking and what someone who is new to the experience of jazz, as I think many of the students are in the room here, what they ought to hear. When I hear that, when I hear the beginning, I always think of the royal fanfare. The king is coming, and the trumpets blare, and in walks in the divine. And I think of Louis that way. And it's funny. There's a wonderful biography of Louis called Pops, and he's quoted as saying, white guys always called me Louie and black guys always called me Louis, and I'm not sure why. And so every time I say Louie, I think, am I supposed to say Louis? But that's a different conversation. What's happening? What should we be hearing, and why is this so important?
Okay. It's important because he's taking a tradition from the white band tradition of the late 19th century of coloratura trumpet solos. That beginning that he's playing is a thing that mimics what the great classical cornetists who played with Sousa, who were the soloists in the band, did. He's playing a cadenza. He's playing it, and he's announcing the queen. The queen is the blues. He takes that cadenza with all of that flourish, with tremendous innovation in jazz. I could talk to you about his use of the triplets. I can talk to you about all of the things that he did that nobody did before that record. And then he plays a gorgeous blues melody, because it's not about the cadenza. It's about the queen. So you sit there and you listen to it, and, you know, I stop the music. I mean, you know, God forgive me. But I don't know if you saw my face when I was listening to it. I can't listen to that thing without paying attention to every single note, because every single note is absolutely perfect, and nobody from his community ever dared do what he just did. And by the way, after West End Blues was released, every trumpet player in the country tried to learn that cadenza. And most of them could play it, and none of them could play it.
So, all right, without slipping into therapy, what's it like to be part of that tradition, to be a tradition in which... I mean, it's like philosophy, right? The very first day of an intro to philosophy class, we introduce students to Plato, possibly the greatest and certainly the most important thinker who ever lived. And we say two things, right? We say, this is the foundation of certainly the entire Western tradition, whatever that means. No one we are going to read is going to be more important and more lasting. You're in your first week of college. Tell me why he's wrong. Right? There's this both awe-inspiring and democratizing experience of philosophy that is both undermining and celebrating failure and success. I'm not entirely sure how to say it. And it feels like there's something similar going on there. How do you play knowing that Louis did something which you'll never get to do?
Okay. Louis Armstrong was one of a bunch of trumpet players who lived a hardscrabble life playing music and trying to survive. He was the original poor boy. He was raised, he learned a trumpet in the orphan's home.
Duke Ellington said of him, he was born poor and died rich and didn't hurt anyone along the way.
Well, he was a marvelous human being besides for being a great trumpet player, which is why he was so successful and why, despite the fact that he had a completely unattractive voice, everybody loved every single note he sang. I mean, he invented not having a good voice that all of the rock and roll musicians now make a living off of. But that's not where I wanted to go with this. At the same time that Louis played, there was a Midwestern white boy named Bix Beiderbecke who was the next great trumpet player who played absolutely nothing like Louis, and yet he played with the same intensity and integrity. And between Louis and Bix, they invented the trumpet style that ended up giving you Dizzy Gillespie on the one hand and Miles Davis on the other, that they showed that there were two sides to the trumpet. There was the flourish and there was the evocation. There was the invocation and there was the evocation. There was bringing the bravura out and there was the intensity and self-reflection. So Bix loved Louis. And he found a way to be Bix Beiderbecke. And Bix died, made a half a dozen records with sort of weird, almost, forgive me, Lawrence Welk-type bands. He played with Paul Whiteman, which was where Lawrence Welk got his ideas from, of having an impeccable band of fabulous musicians playing music that people really like to listen to. And Bix Beiderbecke fit into that band. And that's a metaphor for what every jazz musician of genius did. They fell in love with the music, listening to the greats, and then figured out what they had to contribute.
When we come back, I'm going to play some contrasting music. Confess to a great sin, and then I want to talk a little bit about music theory and how to start thinking about this as more than just the experience of listening. But for the moment, you are listening to Mark Weinstein and Jack Russell Weinstein and a wonderfully engaged audience at the Empire Arts Center in Grand Forks, North Dakota. You're listening to Y Radio, and we'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
We're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Mark Weinstein about the logic of jazz. And I have a favorite jazz track. It's we're going to play it in just a minute. It's a musician, Charles Mingus, who I love so much that we named our first dog after him. But I have this guilt because I think this track is beautiful and challenging and rich. But I also tell everybody that it is the single best music to go into a car wash with. That if you put Wednesday night prayer meeting on your stereo just as you start going into the brush car wash, the images of the water and the brushes and all that, it's almost like a Pink Floyd laser light show. And part of me loves that, and part of me feels incredibly guilty because I'm taking this thing that I know that I regard as incredibly moving work of art, and I feel like I'm trivializing it. So I want to play it. I'd like you, Dad, to contrast a little bit with what you said about Louis and about West End Blues, and then either condemn me to hell or really the philosophical question is there a right way and a wrong way to enjoy a great work of art like a piece of jazz? But Ashley, Wednesday night prayer meeting. So that's probably my all-time favorite track. Most people prefer Mingus Ah-Um, a different album. I think Blues and Roots is great, and I told you that once, and in your Brooklyn way, you used the phrase, you said, son, you got taste in your mouth. Let's contrast that and talk a little bit about what we're supposed to do with it.
Okay. I was being a father when I said you had taste in your mouth, so forgive me.
I'm used to it.
All right. So Mingus was a punk rock jazz musician.
That explains it.
Mingus was living at a time when jazz had become more and more ethereal, more and more intellectual. Everybody was trying to play perfect. Everybody was trying to play sophisticated. And Mingus decided to dip back into not even jazz, but pre-jazz, gospel, roots music. And he was a bass player, so he couldn't show off like Louis Armstrong. Bass players don't get to play fanfares. And he surrounded himself with musicians, none of whom was top rate. None of whom. The only top rate musician that ever played with Mingus was Eric Dolphy, and Eric Dolphy was so weird that nobody realized he was top rate. Mingus surrounded himself with musicians who were solid B-plus, A-minus musicians, and he beat the music out of them in order for them to play jazz that reflected what he saw as the essence of jazz. Now, I recorded an album with a great musician, a piano player, and he said that everybody says jazz is America's classical music, and he said jazz is America's background music. So if the way that you get through the car wash is listening to Mingus, more power to you. Because Mingus was not trying to be a sophisticated, clean, starched musician wearing a nice shirt and a nice fancy tuxedo. He wanted to go back to what he saw as the basis of jazz, the dirt, the roots, the noise of life. And he did it through a sort of faux kind of southern gospel music, but that's not the sound. The sound is New York gritty through the lens of southern gospel music. And that's what the best jazz does. That's what Ellington did. He transformed everything he touched and made you look at many different things through the perspective of something else. Now, these are the great composers of jazz: Mingus, Ellington, and of course Thelonious Monk, the greatest of the three jazz composers.
All right, so let's...
I'm sorry if the answer wasn't what the answer
no,
you
no,
wanted.
No, there's
but
there's
that was the that's my
no,
answer.
No, that's you know, there's no right or wrong answer in Y Radio, and for me it's the exploration. And it's interesting because, especially given what I talked about in the beginning of the show, the fact that you describe it as that gritty New Yorkness is of course something that resonates with me, that brings it onto the subconscious level. And so what I would like to do for a second, especially for the non-musicians who are listening, is I'd like to ask you a little bit about, for lack of a better phrase, the rationality of a musician. So jazz musicians often use what's called a fake book. And if you take a sheet from a fake book, the way it works is you'll get a sheet that's, there's a name of a song, almost always handwritten, despite the fact that it's printed. And on the musical, sort of a handwritten or sloppily music staff, and then there's what are called chord changes on the staff. So the musicians are all going to play E flat. They'll play D minor. They'll play whatever in order. And then there's usually a melody line. The fake book, you know, you're faking like you know the song. The band gets that, and the band plays in unison, and whoever's playing the melody plays the melody. And then there's improvisation. And then there's room for each of the musicians, depending on their role, to create variations on the melody, variations on the changes. Insofar as you can talk to non-musicians about this, what goes through a jazz musician's mind when they're looking at a fake book and they know they're going to play some music and they have to improvise? How do non-musicians understand what's happening in that process?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you a brief story. Then I'm going to do something that maybe you're not going to like.
Wouldn't be the first time.
I'm going to give the audience a logic lesson. Uh-huh. All right, but first the story. A friend of mine who's a historian of flute said he was at a concert in the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and one of the greatest jazz musicians of all times, a Belgian harmonica player of all things called Toots Thielemans, comes up on the stage of the Kennedy Center with this audience in tuxedos with a piano player. And in front of this audience of wealthy music aficionados, he turns to the piano player and he says, "What do you want to play?" And after the concert, goes up to this friend of mine and he says, "Wasn't that hokey?" He said, "You know, what was he doing there? Was he showing off? You mean they didn't know what he was going to play? They weren't..." And my friend asked me, "What's going on?" And I said to him, "That guy, Toots Thielemans, and that piano player have been playing songs, the same 100 songs, 50 songs, 200 songs, their entire lives over and over and over again. And if he said, 'Let's play Misty,' which he had played 1,000 times, it's because he really felt that that was the right vehicle for that audience, and he had perfect confidence that there, and that's why I keep on talking about people, that the shared experience of their playing would enable him to play a performance that was worth being in the Kennedy Center at $200 a seat. Now, logic. I'm going to teach you all of logic, all right? And I'm going to use the same metaphor I use in my classes, and it's a little politically incorrect now with the horrors around us, but it works. Okay? If your head's chopped off, you're dead. Your head's chopped off. What do you know, everybody? Okay.
Very few of you figured that out. I'm a little disturbed.
If your head's chopped off, you're dead. You're not dead. What do you know? Your head's not chopped off. Your computer, that's all it can do. That's all a microchip can do. It can do modus ponens and modus tollens. All basic logic is the result of those two rules.
Those are two Latin phrases for two basic patterns
of
logic.
The first one is modus ponens. The second one is modus tollens. One way gets you something, and the other way gets you rid of something. That's all a computer can do and remember stuff and fetch like a dog on command. Get the ball. The computer can do everything. Jazz musicians got 12 notes. Classical musicians got 12 notes. Some societies only have 5 notes. They're called pentatonic scales. Some societies, they pretend to have more than 12 notes, but I really don't believe it. All of the music in the world comes out of 12 notes. Tell you one more story. Jewish rabbi is brought before Caesar, and Caesar says, I want you to tell me the entire Torah while standing on one foot. And the rabbi says, do to others what you would have them do to you.
No, that's the Hillel. You got it backwards. That's Jesus.
Don't do. Yeah. Jesus was as good as Hillel. Yeah. Don't.
But they just said it differently.
So. Don't do to others what you would not have others.
Do not do to others what is hateful to you.
Say it again.
Do not. That which is hateful to you, do not do unto others.
Okay, but then he says
the negative is different. But that's another conversation.
If you're a logician, you see that those two things are logically equivalent. Yeah. But we won't get into that. But after he says that, he says, now that you know it, go study. Because the golden rule, the maxims of Jesus, the maxims of the great rabbis, are not words. They're instructions for life. The fake book, the chords, the 12 notes, the simple rules of combination that constitute harmony that you can program in a computer easily, even though it's hard to program in a person because people aren't as good at that as computers, those simple rules are the beginning of a life. And music is a life. It's not logic. It's not math. It's life.
Okay, so that leads to a question that I've really been looking forward to asking you, and something that I struggled with for a while. I started taking music classes a few years back at UND. I ended up taking some music theory classes with Dr. Berry, who I will say for all of the audience is one of the single best teachers I've ever had in my entire life. She was astonishingly amazing. And music theory was incredibly hard for me because as a philosopher, theory meant something fairly specific. There was a why. There were reasons that you could offer explanations and justifications and arguments for things. And music theory was about the relationship between notes. It was about what keys or include what notes, what how to spell chords. But there was no, at least as I understood it, no why. There was no justification. It just is what it is. So A, is that true? When we talk about music theory, when we talk about these are the keys, these are the progressions, these are how you spell the chords, that it just is, there's no why. And if there's no why, why? How can you have a system that doesn't have a justification?
Music theory isn't music theory. Music theory is a course that you teach people to teach them how to spell music. They call it music theory to distinguish it from music performance. Music performance is playing on an instrument. Music theory is knowing the intellectual components that comprise what you play on an instrument. Real music theory is like the relationship, and now we're getting to my area of expertise, is like the relationship between logic and metamathematics. I could teach you all logic in 2 seconds, but metamathematics is the study of logical systems to understand why a computer, using those 2 rules, can do everything that a computer can do, or why arithmetic that any child can learn morphs into calculus and morphs into number theory and morphs into areas that are so incredibly difficult. Because within the kernel of the components of music is everything that music becomes. So real music theory is not learning how to spell chords. It's analysis. It's taking a piece of music, once you know the alphabet, and figuring out how the difference between Bach and Handel and Beethoven and Mozart and Charlie Mingus and Louis Armstrong and Chaim Moshe and everybody else use those components to create music.
So is there no reason why a G scale has 1 flat?
One sharp,
right? I had a 50% chance. I blew it. I got the one right. Is there no reason why G has 1 sharp?
Sure. The reason is really simple. It's the reason that Jack is spelled J-A-C-K, because that's a G scale. Now, why is a G scale a G scale? Because there are 12 notes, and the 12 notes have white notes and black notes. But every scale has a certain pattern. Whole step, half step, whole step, whole step.
All right, let me stop for the audience a second. For those who are not musicians or have never taken any music classes, do your best to imagine a piano keyboard, because the piano keyboard is the best way to envision the relationship between notes. It's why, and I'm telling my daughter this, who's in the audience somewhere, it's why no matter what instrument you play, you have to learn how to play the piano. Because it illustrates the relationship between the intervals and between the various different notes and when there's a flat and there's a sharp. And so what he's talking about, white keys and black keys, he's talking about the piano keyboard and how it illustrates the 12 notes and their relationship.
Okay, but all right, so I wish I had a blackboard. So if you think of the piano keyboard and you play one note, there's either a black note in between or there isn't a black note in between. There's a black note in between, then that's a half step, and so the white notes is a whole step. If there's no black note in between, that's a half step. So if you start on C, then you play the whole step, half step, et cetera, with all white notes. If you start on G, then in order to have that same ratio, you have to play an F sharp. If you start on F, in order to have that same ratio, you have to play a B flat.
Okay, so you're talking about ratios, and you say, you know, the G scale is the G scale for the same reason that Jack is spelled J-A-C-K. Jack is spelled J-A-C-K because there was an accident of history that then led to a logical system based on the nature of our alphabet, the nature of phonetics, the nature of things that I don't understand. Was music invented or discovered?
Okay, so you always want to talk about music and mathematics. So the Pythagoreans, ancient Greeks, developed an instrument that now every music student has to learn from. It's called a monochord. What a monochord is a string pasted onto a piece of wood that has a ruler. If you cut the string in half, you get an octave. If you cut the string in third, in three pieces, you get a fifth. So if you cut the string in a whole number ratio, you get different notes. If you pile them on one after another, but then octave reduce them into the same octave, you get something like a scale. So that's a phenomena of physics, that if you cut a string in half, if you cut a string in a third, if you cut a string in a fourth, if you cut a string in a fifth, something happens. Now, here's what's interesting historically. Why did the Greeks cut things into whole number ratios? That's because they were primitive mathematicians and they didn't know decimals. So they cut things into whole number ratios because that's the one mathematics they knew. If you're going to tune a piano, then the ratios get a little funny, but that gets us into a whole other thing. So the question is the fact that music is 12 notes, is the fact that when we play later and play Jewish traditional music, we're playing the same three chords that every rock and roll band plays, that every folk music plays. We're playing tonics, the bass chord, dominant, the chord that leads to the tonic, and the subdominant, the chord that the tonic leads to. Why does all music have that? That's one of the mysteries of music theory. Is it something about the human brain? Is it something about the human ear? Is it something that shows that God, in her wisdom, has made the whole world comprehensible? And so when we listen to music, it makes sense to us because the very structure of our ears and our brain resonate with the basic structures of sound? That's metaphysics. That's mysticism. But the fact is that every society, with the exception of societies that just have percussion instruments like Indonesia, uses some version, some similar version of the scale that you find just by going your finger with your thumb across a piano. Now, sophisticated societies have altered those scales slightly, and the scale of the piano is actually a compromise so that Bach could write something called the well-tempered clavier, because if you do that Pythagorean thing with the string, an F sharp and a G flat are two different notes slightly. Now, that gets really, really complicated. You have to be a music major. And I became a philosophy I was a music major. I became a philosopher because, compared to music, philosophy courses were easy.
And I will say, and I've said it for the record, when I started taking music classes at UND, whatever it was, 5 years ago or so, hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
But the reason that basic music is hard is different than the reason why understanding why an F sharp and a G flat are two different notes and how Bach resolves it so he can move more freely across the keyboard, across the keys. Right. Now, jazz musicians, that's what jazz musicians love to do. And I'd like you to play what you want to play, and I'll tell you what creativity in music is really about. Okay? All right. That's a promise.
All right. Ashley, would you play John Coltrane's Giant Steps?
Thank you.
music has 12 notes. 12 is an interesting number. You can divide it by 2, you can divide it by 3, and you can divide it by 4. Right? Okay? Jazz musicians, everybody always divides it into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That's the 8 version of the 12. Okay? Jazz musicians got sophisticated. That's playing in one key, G major, with the one sharp. Jazz musicians wanted to play all of the notes in between. And jazz musicians divided the scale in by 4. So jazz musicians would play C, E flat, F sharp, A, C, divide the scale into 4 pieces that constitute what's called a diminished chord. And all of bebop, all of Beethoven, can be explained in terms of using that diminished chord as a pivot to fool around. Coltrane broke the octave into 3 parts.
Just for those who don't know, an octave is when you're going up a scale and you get to the same note. So C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, that's an octave.
All right, but here's the point. Everybody had broken it into 4 parts. He broke it into 3. So he moved from a C to an E natural to a G sharp to the C. And that gave an entire generation of new jazz musicians a whole new way of playing. And that's why I told you that business about logic. Because the beauty of the creativity is to take something basic and fundamental and explore it in new and different ways. And since music only has 12 notes, there aren't that many ways to cut it up. So creativity, and Coltrane made a revolution in jazz improvisation by saying you can change the way you cut the octave up.
Okay, I want to throw a different piece of music at this conversation. I put it on the list because I love it and because it's meaningful for a variety of reasons. And a family friend, Tony, who's passed away a long time ago, introduced me to this track. But I want us to talk about how we go from that kind of complexity to emotion and simplicity, and how the voice works with this system. So, Ashley, would you play Billie Holiday's All of Me? Didn't play this track because it breaks my heart every single time. For personal reasons, but also because there's something about the way that Billy sings lips. That moment in the song cuts me. Why? And I don't mean why because of my personal history. I mean, no one in my experience can do what Billy is doing. And this is an alternative track. This track took me a long time to track down. I used to have this track. We shared a house for a while with a guy named Tony, who I was sort of growing up with, and I shared a room with for a while because we were very poor. And when he died, part of my inheritance was this collection of vinyl, Smithsonian classic jazz albums. And this was on it. And until the internet became the internet and until Apple Music became Apple Music, I couldn't find this version. I've heard Billy sing All of Me in 10 different versions at least. I love them all. But this, why? It's not about cutting up the scale. It's not about ratios. What's she doing?
Okay, two things. The first thing, it is about cutting up the scale, and it is about ratios, because it's a beautiful melody because it does something very interesting. It goes to, it changes key on the second chord, and then it goes back. It goes, if you're playing the key C, it goes to C to a D major chord that has an F sharp, but then it goes back to C. So the very first statement of the melody takes a little detour, and it's a detour that every other Duke Ellington song takes. It's an interesting musical detour because it has a kind of poignancy. It moves away from the key, and then it comes back. So the song that she picked had a kind of harmonic motion that gives the listener a sense of completion, because it's a tiny little, like it's a little Japanese haiku, that first phrase of that song, because that's where the harmony works. Billie Holiday, probably the greatest jazz singer that ever lived, according to musicians, and by far the single worst singer in the entire history of music. She had a range of a little more than an octave. Yep. She couldn't do any of the things that Sarah Vaughan did. She couldn't do any of the things that Ella Fitzgerald did. She didn't have the chops. She couldn't improvise. She could do a sting of melody. And when she sang a melody, she never made it more complicated. She always made it more simple. If you listen to Lawrence Welk play that melody, the melody he's going to play is going to have more different notes than the melody she sang. But as my Uncle Irving, the klezmer musician from Poland, used to say, she knew how to put over a song. She knew how to use the words and the inflection of her voice and her limited vibrato, certainly not an operatic vibrato, to express something human. And she picked a song in All of Me that had the harmonic basis to turn to make that movement possible. Now, notice what I'm doing. I'm giving you a technical basis, but what it is a human phenomena. The thing about music, and this is what I said when I did my radio interview, the thing about music in general is that people play it. And the thing about jazz is that people play it in a community of like-minded individuals who share a commitment to a very, very hard life in order to play this music. And Billie Holiday, who had one of the hardest lives of all, epitomized for every musician she played with the integrity and emotional directness that every jazz musician strives for. And the emotional directness that every rock and roll musician achieves who has a successful record.
Explain that.
Well, rock and roll speaks to people. That's why people make millions and millions of dollars. It's easy to express emotions with an electric guitar with a wah-wah pedal. But jazz musicians try to express that emotion in different ways. Billie Holiday did it with minimalism. Ahmad Jamal, another great piano player, did it with minimalism. Early Miles Davis did it with minimalism. Mingus did it with primitivism. Coltrane did it with harmonic sophistication, and we cut off his solo. You know, he's playing a million notes a minute. But it's all the attempt to try to take this social cultural phenomena, and I got to say it this way, I'm sorry if I offend people, the social and cultural phenomena that jazz musicians created for themselves so that they could play jazz and then use that as a way to express what they could contribute to that phenomena. And second-rate jazz musicians like me try as hard as they can to make a contribution. And now that jazz is a university industry and everybody is teaching everybody how to play jazz, everybody is aspiring to somehow get a piece of this. It's the same reason you go to Venice. It's the same reason you go to the pyramids. It's you want to have a piece of something magnificent. And jazz is magnificent. And there is no greater joy in life than to struggle to get a piece of it. And every jazz musician does it a different way. Billy did it with no chops, no technique, but with tremendous heartfulness, soul, if you permit the expression.
All right, so then I guess I want to ask the question that Aristotle never got to ask unless you read The Name of the Rose, which is, where's the humor? I want to play another track, Oscar Peterson and Clark Terry, a song called Mumbles. So first of all, for the record, we got a new puppy about 5.5 months ago, and we discovered very early on that he loves this song. his ears perk up, and his name is Oscar, so it works. This is not a sophisticated way to ask the question, so I hope you understand what I'm asking. It's not all serious, right? I mean, it's Billy has a hard life, Mingus has a hard life, but there's room for levity.
Dead serious. Clark Terry's working musician, and he wants to have a hit record. And he goes into the studio with Oscar Pettiford, who's one of the great piano players of all times, and they're messing around, yes and no. And Louis played the blues, and Mingus played gospel, and Oscar Peterson plays a gospel introduction, and they play a gospel-flavored blues. And Clark Terry I don't know if this is a word that you can say. If you're going to have to bleep me out, it's not a bad word. Clark Terry does a piss take on scat singing, because scat singing is the thing that Louis Armstrong invented. You know, Clark Terry's a trumpet player, right, just like Louis Armstrong. Right. Louis Armstrong invented the singing without words, and it got him over. His singing got him over. His trumpet playing made him a genius, revered among jazz musicians, but his singing is, you know, It's a Wonderful Life. Everybody loves that song. Everybody loves Louis Armstrong. And so Clark Terry is taking Louis Armstrong's scat singing and taking it absolutely to the furthest extreme of blah, 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 blah. And he had a hit record. He had a hit record. And musicians, in order to live that lifestyle, have to eat. So fooling around is dead serious if it's going to give you a hit record. But the beauty of it is that he takes three basic things, gospel, blues, and scat, and in an absolutely masterful performance, blends them into something that even a dog can get off on.
I was going to come up with another question, but I think we're done here. This has been a great pleasure, and I couldn't think of a better person to share 10 years with. Thanks, Dad. Thanks for joining us on Why.
I'm really proud of my son. I'm going to be 79 years old, and I can think of nothing I wanted to do less than to freeze my Hoosets off in February. And I couldn't say no to Jack, because I think what he's done over these 10 years, and I'm a professional philosopher. I publish in this obscure field called the philosophy of chemistry. I mean, I teach teacher education, but I publish in all of these obscure fields. What he's done to philosophy is a miracle. He's made philosophy something that people can relate to in the same way that when you go to an Italian restaurant in New Jersey, they're playing John Coltrane. It's a miracle.
Well, let's plan for another miracle in another 10 years. You've been listening. You've been listening to Mark Weinstein and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I will be back with a few more thoughts right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We have been talking with Mark Weinstein about the logic of jazz. Not surprising to me, the conversation didn't have that much to do with logic, because that was a gimmick. It was a gimmick that got my father on the stage. It was a gimmick that connected the music with philosophy, because jazz is hard to think about. It's hard to think about it because there's so much. There's perceived snobbery. There's, in a sense, jazz is like wine. People drink it, but then they're the people who claim to know all about it. And they look down, in some senses, on the people who just drink it because they like the taste. But that's not fair to the musicians. It's not fair to anybody, and it's certainly not fair to jazz. Jazz is the music of my life, even before I knew it. It's something that I grew into. I've been lucky enough that I developed over my lifetime a catalog of jazz musicians and jazz tracks, including my own father, who I could listen to with curiosity and with pleasure, with awe, with anger, with frustration, with lust, with every emotion I experience with jazz. Because it's about the people, it's about the musician, and it's about the experience. So as someone who was an involuntary jazz listener, for someone who has been immersed in it without choice and is grateful every day, to all of you who feel overwhelmed, just listen. Pick some music and listen. See where it takes you. You're listening to Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. It has been our 10th anniversary party at the Empire Arts Theater, and I will end it the way I always do by telling you that it is my deepest honor to be with you. Thank you very much.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua e Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.